like waved my arms in the air and knocked our microphone over, and it fell onto the laptop and stopped the recording, and it was a mess. It was so bad.
I don't know, it sounds good to me.
Another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are my co-host, Richard Wally.
And from sunny California, you are Cassidy Robinson. And we've got a guest.
We do.
What?
Oh.
From Long Beach, we have actress, podcaster, and flight attendant, Alyssa Whitty.
That's me. Hi, everybody.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is super cool.
You are the co-host and co-creator of our sister podcast. I'll elevate you guys up to sibling now instead of just being your uncle.
We've
podcast.
Been calling you uncle. So. Yes. All right, brother. I host the Quarter Life Crisis podcast with Brad and Amanda, who have been guests on your show.
Yes.
Which is, and now it's my turn. So they're really jealous that I'm here and they're not. So.
I know. I felt like it was like. I didn't mean it to be that way, but I texted you, and then they found out about it through you, so they're like, what the hell?
It's all good. I just mentioned that I was coming.
Right. I think you were actually with them when I was texting you.
Yeah. It's like, hey, I'm gonna go. They're like, how dare you?
You're pod cheating right now.
Yeah, I'm cheating on the podcast.
How does it feel?
I feel dirty, but also really happy.
Good. Good.
Well, we're in a polyamorous podcast relationship, so you're okay.
That's so cool.
Very
so
Portland.
So progressive.
Yeah.
Yes, very Portland. You have no idea.
Oh, boy.
So, let's talk a little bit. I wanted mention Quarter Life Crisis, because you're going through sort of a transition right now of programming.
Yeah, we've completely reformatted. Mm-hmm. We were just... For like 17, 18 episodes in a row, we were just like, let's talk at the microphone for an hour and then put it up, and we had, nobody cared. So now we are a interview podcast. We've been finding cool local people who do cool local things, like bands and artists and comic book shop owners and stuff, and we've been interviewing them. And also, Brad and I have a new segment where we challenge each other to really stupid writing contests and then write stories for each other and read them aloud on
the
air. So
the Knob Down mini-sodes.
Yeah. So that's been really fun, and those have been getting really good responses. We're just kind of finding our footing. I mean, we're 24 episodes in, and we're just kind of finding a new spot, a new... thing that we're good at.
Right.
So we've been meeting some really cool people. Last week we put up the episode where we interviewed Countless Thousands, which is this awesome band out of Hollywood. This week, tomorrow, actually, I don't know when this is going to be posted, but this week it's Glynis, I already forgot her last name, the super cool girl who owns Comic Book Hideout, a comic book shop in Fullerton, California. And then Jen Sese, a really sweet local caricature artist who agreed to meet us at a Starbucks. So that was kind of a difficult episode with all the Starbucks noise. But, but it's been really fun, and there's been some good cross promotion going on. Mm-hmm. We love helping out local people. So now we're going to re-cross promote you guys by me being on this podcast. So
that's the point. That's the point.
It's very exciting.
We're exploitive. We didn't, you know.
Yeah, every there's a bottom line to all of it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, you're cool, but I mean, let's get real. I'm just kidding.
Feel so used.
I think it takes about a good 25 episodes for any podcast to really find its footing. We always joke about Jabber and the Drone 1.0 and Jabber and the Drone 2.0, because when we first started doing this, we were just using like a $14 Logitech mic. It sounded like garbage.
Awesome.
Or sometimes we just record right off the mic from the laptop.
We did that once. The episode that I took over the podcast.
Yeah.
We couldn't find a mic, so it was just...
Just the laptop.
Just the laptop. It was bad. It was really bad.
So you're also an actress. I mentioned that on the top of the show. Do you want to mention some of your more well-known credits?
Well, see... All right. So I've done mostly stage work in more recent years, but when I hit the prime of my career, like the peak of my career in the year 2001, when I was like 11. I did a lot of extra work and stuff. I was in a lot of TV growing. I mean, you grow up in the LA area.
Right.
I had an agent and everything. I was in an episode of Seinfeld, did an episode of Malcolm in the Middle, Baywatch. I played baby Gina Lee Nolan in an episode of Baywatch in a flashback. So that was super cool. That one's on YouTube.
Yeah.
And I was in the movie Very Bad Things. I was the flower girl in the wedding.
And you weren't allowed to know anything about the movie until you were older.
I still haven't seen it, so...
I actually have it. It's in my collection.
You know what? There it is. I haven't seen it yet, but I heard it's super dark, so
yeah.
That's cool.
Pretty dark. And it's one of the only, like, Cameron Diaz roles that I'm, like, way into.
Okay, yeah. I remember this was just before Charlie's Angels, I think. Like, she hadn't really...
Peaked
yet?
Yeah.
But she was really nice. And then I moved to stage. I did a lot of theater in college, a lot of Shakespeare. I did a couple of web series for a friend. And now I'm kind of starting to get back into it now that I'm back living in LA. I want to do more film, because it's been a while since I've done film.
Right. Do you find it harder now than it was, like, in the late 90s, early 2000s? Like, I mean, I don't know if you have any conception of what it was like back then, or if you were just kind of being dragged around by a stage mom.
Amazingly, my mom was the opposite of a stage mom. She was not interested in taking me to a bunch of auditions and, like, turning me into... I just had a really great agent who was a friend of my mom's, who would just call up and be like, hey, I have a part for Alyssa. Show up at this time at this place. And that was, I even knew back then that I was really lucky. But I hit my growth spurt really fast, and I kind of started standing out too much to be just an extra or just, like, in the background, you know? Or, you know, I wasn't blending in with kids my own age. Mm-hmm. And it became harder for me to get roles because I was really tall for 12, and I was really blonde. Mm-hmm. And they were like, this is not the kind of girl you can just throw in the background, but I wasn't into auditions and because all the people that I knew who were really serious about it, they were all mean.
I think you have to be, don't you?
You do. You really do. And I didn't learn that until much later when I was like, oh, I could have been really good at that.
Yeah.
Could have made a name for myself as a child actor. But also I hate child actors. I hate them now. I don't like movies with little kids in the starring role,
right.
Unless they're exceptional.
Mm-hmm. And, unless you have a Freddie Highmore or something like that.
Or like, have you ever seen The Fall with Lee Pace?
The Tarsem movie?
Yeah.
The crazy ass? Mm-hmm. No, I know of it, but I haven't seen it.
It's one of my favorite movies of all time. The little girl in it, Katinka Antara, I think is her name. She's incredible. She's absolutely exceptional in that movie. She was like 5 years old and barely spoke English.
Yeah.
And one of the most amazing performances I've seen by a kid. So I'll watch that movie and her all the time. But I can't watch, like the second Indiana Jones movie, I refuse to watch it.
Because of
the short round kid, I won't watch it. I can't. He's the part of that movie that bothers me the most.
And usually everyone complains about his girlfriend in that movie.
Who was like the real wife of her. She's Spielberg. Annoying. She's annoying too, but it's Short Round that I absolutely cannot stand. So it's, this background has given me a kind of a weirder perspective when I watch movies. Yeah. Knowing a lot of the movie magic and stuff that goes into it.
You know the ingredients of the cake
knowing,
kind of thing.
Yeah, like I do pay a lot of attention to extras and the crowd extras and stuff because I'm like, I used to do that and I know people who still do. I'll recognize certain tricks and stuff that they use that I remember from when I was a kid. And now that makes me, instead of driving me away from it, it's making me want to go back. I do really do miss it.
Well, cool.
So I'm going back. Y'all, you'll see me in Hollywood. Name and lights. All that jazz.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into the show proper. You came prepared, Alyssa, with a pet topic for us.
I did.
And I'm interested to hear how this goes. What did you want to talk about?
Okay, so I wanted to bring a pet topic in because you asked me if I would. So I thought long and hard about topics that don't usually go with as far as I don't know. You guys are like film critics. You critique a film kind of as a whole. You know a lot more than I do about cinematography and directing and stuff like that. But I know and care a lot about the acting side of it. And I was thinking about and reading a book about the portrayal of mental illness in various characters. And I wanted to hear you guys talk, and I'll contribute too, about good performances, bad performances, portraying mental illness on film. The most recent example that I could come up with of a movie that dealt with it directly was Silver Linings Playbook, which was my first example. And that movie to me has two good and one bad portrayals of mental illness in it when I thought about their portrayal of depression, of bipolar disorder, of OCD, of all of these different struggles, mental illnesses, and how a director and an actor can work together to make it a non-offensive, interesting, but also real performance. I thought De Niro and Cooper both did a really good job in that movie, but Jennifer Lawrence, as much as I love her, her performance didn't feel as real. I felt like they cherry picked a bunch of symptoms of different mental illnesses just to make her a more interesting character, and then kind of forgot about a diagnosis altogether. But De Niro played OCD just incredible.
Yeah.
And Bradley Cooper, I've never seen him play a role like that. I mean, you see him as kind of the pretty boy or an action hero or something like that. But this was really...
His first real big breakout into prestige pictures.
Yeah, and I thought he did a really good job. But for me, it was all about Robert De Niro in that movie.
Yeah, especially since it's been so long since we've seen him do anything with a lot of weight to it.
And I thought he portrayed that role and that particular set of mental illness, like, really... honestly, and without any, he wasn't like winking at it at all. And that's what I thought the movie did a good job. But then, I don't know. So that's the train of thought that got me going on this pet topic. I want to hear what you guys have to say, especially Richard, now that I know that you studied psychology, just finding that out. I want to know what you think about what is Hollywood and the movie industry and stuff. What do they do right and wrong when it comes to things like that?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on each person. Like, me personally, I'm never... as long as the rules of the movie make sense within its own, like, realm, within the film itself, I'm usually okay, even if it's not completely realistic. Sometimes films, like, if you're, like... Let's talk about something like... this isn't, like, mental disorders, but it's kind of plays in a psychological ballpark, like something like Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
You're not getting reality. It's operatic. It's big. It's, you know, horrific. But that's what the film is trying to be, you know?
Right.
And so with something like Silver Linings Playbook, I even liked Jennifer Lawrence in that. I thought that they
I didn't not like Jennifer Lawrence in that. I thought she's a great actress and she did a good job. But I felt that as real as the other characters were, hers felt more cherry-picked and more like, oh, let's keep her pretty and non-threatening. Mm-hmm. I felt like they didn't take any risks with her.
See, and I thought hers was more about, I think she had a, where Robert De Niro and Bradley Cooper was more of a biological kind of mental disorder, where mm-hmm. they, like, just obviously it was in the family, that kind of thing.
Right.
With Jennifer Lawrence's character, it was more brought on by life events. And that's kind of what I liked about her portrayal, because it was more about, like, her grieving her husband because her husband had passed.
That's right. True. And that's so, a good way to look at it.
And her kind of acting out. And
yeah. And so
yeah,
I wasn't even sure if they gave her a specific diagnosis
in that movie.
No,
I thought
they didn't.
Depression,
yeah,
sort of.
And she just, I don't know. I get that. Now that I think about it, that's true. You think about the biological or whatever versus the
situational.
Yeah. That's definitely the word I was going for. Situational, as far as Jennifer Lawrence's character. That's true. I always felt when I was watching that I wanted her to have a bigger break or have a more
pronounced.
Yeah. I wanted them to take a bigger risk with her because she was so pretty and she's so talented. And I felt like they just kind of went, oh, she's sort of damaged. Let's leave it at that. Mm. And they let her do a really safe performance to me. I don't know. I felt like they could have just done a lot more with her and made it a lot more dynamic.
Well, I have no psychology background, so I just go off of how much I enjoy the performance. One of mine, I think, and it's also because of the way the movie's shot and it's all from his perspective, but it really kind of sucks you into a really sick mindset, is Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver is Travis Bickle. I'm not even sure what that is a portrayal of, but I don't want it, whatever it is. I think it's, you know, probably borderline schizophrenic, but I don't know. What would you say, Richard, if you were to diagnose Robbie D in
Well, with my bachelor's degree, no.
You have complete legal right to diagnose people, even fictional.
Well, actually, you don't have to have to do counseling. You actually don't even have to have a BA. Keep that in mind. That one could be schizophrenic, definitely. I mean, the only thing that I would caution with that is that, I mean, a schizophrenic, he wouldn't, most cases when people attack people, or a violent crime, they have no mental disorder.
they're just bad people.
They're just bad people, or they grew up in a criminal element, or whatever, or they're inebriated. That's often a big case.
But he's definitely delusional.
Oh, he's crazy as shit. I mean, if in those movies, when that kind of thing happens, it's, you know, getting back to, because kind of some of the stuff I know a lot about, and it's not just my not just that I was doing a program. Mm-hmm. In psychology, but also because I know a lot about serial killers, you know, there's a really big fantasy aspect to a lot of the folks that do violent crimes. And so him pulling out the gun like a billion times in front of the mirror and stuff like that, I thought that was a really interesting, and maybe more like a gunman shooting up a school or something. Maybe it's more closely related to that.
Enacting a fantasy.
Yeah, I don't know. So that one definitely is somebody who's delusional.
Mm-hmm.
Schizophrenic, maybe. I mean, you don't really hear him talking about voices or you don't really hear him, like, you know, it's more about the sick fantasy for him, you know?
Right.
And it's more about him not dealing with the actual shit that's around. Like, it's him living inside his head, so...
Yeah.
One of the movies that I always like, if we're talking about like psychology, and it's obvious, but I think it needs to be talked about, is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That film, first of all the side characters, you know, the great thing was when you go into the clinic is it does actually feel like a clinic.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just like, you know, people kind of sitting around brooding. And people look drugged. People look like they're, you know, a little off.
Yeah.
And that's been more my experience with going to places like that. And so, but what's interesting about Jack Nicholson's performance in it is that specifically he, like...
He's healthy in the movie, isn't he? He decided to take a chance with the courts and went there instead of jail.
See, I always thought it was really questionable. Is he completely healthy or is he bipolar? And there are diagnoses that it's like, it could be, you know, is the guy an asshole and just that's his problem? Or is there actually something going on here?
I think that's definitely supposed to be left up to interpretation. You're not supposed to, you get his motivation at the beginning. Yeah, like, oh, I'm going to go here instead of jail. That's clearly a better, well, obviously.
Yeah.
Didn't work out so well. But that maybe it turned out that he did belong there anyways. Yes.
And he just worked it out in his mind, so it was his choice instead of somebody else's.
Exactly.
Mm. Well, it's also, almost crazier than a lot of the people in there.
Yeah. Well, he's more disruptive, that's for sure.
It has been a really, really long time since I've seen that. But yeah, that's a really good one to bring up in this conversation. I was going to go for the opposite of that in the most offensive way imaginable. Did you guys see that horribly offensive movie, The Ringer? With that Johnny Knoxville?
Yes.
That's the one I was thinking of.
It's like the literal opposite of that and the most offensive.
Right. It's basically the comedy version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's just bad. And that's disrespectful and it's crude. And I'm not going to lie, when I saw it, I laughed my ass off because, yeah, I was like, it was comedy. I felt like horrible. I felt like I'm going to hell for laughing at this. But it's bad. That's not a respectful or realistic.
Right.
Well,
didn't they use actually handicapped people in the movie?
They had a handful of people. They had a handful of Down syndrome actors. They had a couple of, but the whole lead cast was all faking it.
So that's even more offensive.
It's so uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, because Joe Latruglio is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. When the fuck did we get ice cream? That's oh, God. I'll never forget it. But so that's what I mean, there's one thing to just talk about movies individually, but what do you guys think about like the industry as a whole? Do they have respect for things like that? Do they exploit it?
I think the industry as a whole is looking to exploit whatever they can whenever they can. I don't think they have many scruples. I do think that there are portrayals of certain things, like obviously mental illnesses that have been discredited by science, because people still talk about how we only use 10% of our brain, which is bullshit. And it's still a sci-fi trope for some reason. But things like depression, I think people are kind of walking around a little softer now, or things like multiple personality disorder. You don't see as many movies about that anymore.
Yeah, because I think
what's the name of that book, Richard?
What's the book?
What?
The DSM-5?
Yeah.
Isn't that what they're on now? 5.
The Diagnostic Statistic Manual.
Nice. It is. Number 5. It's not multiple personality. It's a dissociative identity disorder, and it's like, they're really not sure if it's a thing.
Yeah.
And so I think,
well, Sybil, so the main case of that, the main case study, she actually came out and basically said she was lying. It was all bullshit.
Right. Yeah.
So that pioneer, kind of discredits it a little bit.
The pioneer, like,
the main
let's talk
case,
about,
yeah.
Well, it was multiple personalities at MPD then, but now it's DID, and they're like, well, now she says she's faking. Is everybody else faking? They're not sure if that's a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so many tropes that base themselves on multiple personalities, mm-hmm. and like who was fronting when and which. I can go back to Daredevil for a second. One of Daredevil, my favorite Daredevil villain, Typhoid Mary, her whole shtick was which personality is fronting at what time.
Yeah,
and are you talking to Mary? Are you talking to Typhoid? Are you talking to Bloody Mary? You know, like, you don't know, because she's...
And there's a lot of Batman villains that use that as a... Mm-hmm. Like, both Two-Face and Scarface are both multiple personality.
Yeah, and now that's kind of... It's kind of becoming a thing you don't really talk about, because now it's not real. Or you're not sure if it's real or not.
Right.
Well,
but I don't think they're ever going to surrender making up... What is that show that was on for so long about the...
Something about the United States of Terra.
United States of Terra. That's yeah, it. Yeah. It was all about different personalities. Mm-hmm. Is that still on? I don't know.
No, I think it had a run for like 3 or 4 seasons. Tony Collette.
Finished.
It's
yeah.
on
yeah.
Netflix. Yeah. I saw it on Netflix last night when I was looking for the Purple Rose of Terra. I don't know why it came up related.
Yeah.
I just want to, really quick, because okay. I want to go back to the Ringer for a second. I don't want to say that I know the difference between like a mental illness and yeah. like a chromosomal illness, like Down syndrome.
Right.
I want to say like I know the difference between those, and I'm not like trying to lump that
conflate
all in together.
Right.
You know, oh, it's all just illness. I mean, like I know I just wanted to talk about movies.
You're off the hook.
Thank you.
Nobody thinks you're a terrible person.
I want the listeners to know that I'm aware of the difference.
Well, just as a wrap up, I guess, that's kind of the thing that about like psychology in general in media is mm-hmm. like, I worked for this professor who got like interviewed by People and different things about the work she was doing on. And it always got like, they always made their own interpretation of it. That wasn't scientific, and it wasn't like her, like what she was really, what her studies and what she was really saying. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's really about people not actually understanding what those things are. And unless you have like a direct case, like Silver Linings Playbook, for example, I know that David O. Russell specifically did that because his son has really bad manic
depression.
Bipolar disorder. And so that's the difference. If somebody actually gives a shit, then there's a reason to make a real movie about it. If somebody doesn't and isn't interested in it, they're just going to do kind of this shambly thing that they throw together.
Right.
I agree. Very well said.
Well, let's go ahead and get into Big Hero 6.
Yay!
Which was the big money winner, I want to say, maybe, of the last couple weeks. We're a little
it's
behind.
Done very, very well.
Yeah. This is produced by Disney.
Surprise,
and
surprise.
Do you want to set that up? What is it about?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Big Hero 6. It's a newest by Disney cartoon about a futuristic combination of San Francisco and Tokyo. San Francisco. which is actually, it took a lot of practice to be able to say that. And... it's about a kid who's extremely intelligent for his age, who has a lot of familial loss and makes friends with a robot, turns his friends into superheroes, and fights crime. So that's just the general sum up of the movie.
Sure.
I saw it on Friday with my mom.
Mm-hmm.
I cried like a baby because I am a big baby. I'm a huge baby. Everything makes me cry. The little short at the beginning with the puppy made me cry. But I wear my emotions on my sleeve, so sue me.
That's good. You get involved. You get yeah. into the movie. Yeah.
I really liked it. I really mm-hmm. enjoyed myself while I was watching the movie. The script had some problems. There's a line that really stuck out that was just really bad, where the little kid, Hero, his name is Hero, that's so cute. little Hero says to his older brother, he says something like, the brother says something about, oh, our parents would be, like, ashamed of you, and he says, well, our parents died when I was 3, remember?
Yeah.
And it was like, oh.
It's clearly an expositional line.
It was super expositional, but also that remember thrown at the end of it was like, how would he forget? It's so unnecessary. Like, I don't know. That was, and little things like that mm-hmm. where the script...
mostly in dialogue, or
the dialogue really really suffered in some points that they were trying to tell rather than show.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, the story I thought was really fun.
Mm-hmm.
I love the big robot Baymax.
Yeah,
he was super great.
Big
was
inflatable robot,
big
which is an
inflatable cuddly robot,
which we never like seen a robot like that in film before.
I know he was all vinyl and inflated with air, and he could inflate or deflate as he needed. He was not your just all metal robot. I am, or he was, and he wasn't an android made to look human. He was just a big blob of white vinyl, which was.
And he's originally really programmed to be a nurse. So his operative, standing or what he's supposed to do is to care for. So he is this really, really benevolent, almost to a fault all the time.
Yeah. And he was just really sweet. I thought that his internal programming, one of the high points of the movie for me, his programming was really consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Although everything that he did could be justified by he's trying to take care of his patient. He's trying to take care of his patient. So even when all of a sudden they give him wings and a super suit and they're like, you're a superhero now. He goes, so long as I can take care of my patient, you know, like, which he stayed really consistent all the way to the end. He was definitely my favorite. He was so cute. And the supporting cast was all really interesting.
Do you think it's interesting that, they call it Big Hero 6? And ultimately what happens in the movie is it becomes this almost sort of Incredibles superhero movie with a team. And that's why it's called the Big Hero 6 is because there's six of them. But the trailers were being really cagey about that. They made it look more like it was just going to be about this boy and his robot. Do you think it's interesting that they
hid
that?
All of a sudden the superhero thing came out of nowhere. You're right. I didn't know anything about the story before I saw it. And then all of a sudden, boom, superheroes. Mm-hmm. They all have color-coded outfits that go with their personalities and different.
Mm-hmm.
And all of their powers obviously come from their technology, which was established from the beginning that they're living in the future. Yeah. They go to nerd school. They're so... That was...
Robotic school, yeah.
That was adorable. It was weird. It did kind of come out of nowhere. All of a sudden, it was a superhero movie.
Yeah.
Should have got it from the title that has hero in it, like superhero.
But then you hear the kid's name is Hero.
Right.
And Hero, like, in the sense, like, oh, this robot could be his hero. Like, I kind of thought it would be like an Iron
Giant.
A big
robot is a hero.
Right.
I didn't know where six came from. I just thought it was...
I thought maybe it was, like, his model or something. Like, he's the sixth model.
And then all of a sudden there are five people in one robot being a superhero team.
I just thought it was interesting that the movie is so overtly about superheroes and comic books and living in kind of a Comic-Con world that we live in now.
Yeah.
And like it's also a lot of, I think, anime inflection in there too, especially San Francisco. and like the main character is of Asian descent.
Hero. I don't remember. He was so cute. His animation was clearly Kingdom Hearts inspired.
Mm-hmm.
You look at his giant feet and his giant hair and his teeny little body.
Yeah.
He's like straight out of Kingdom Hearts.
Yeah.
So the whole thing was like, it was simultaneously superhero movie, but also video game and anime inspired.
Yeah.
So a lot of different clashes of design going into this movie, but I thought it worked.
It looks really great.
It was really consistent, like, as far as which... There were some bits. And you look at the street. The camera's flying up the street and you get the cute little San Francisco houses all lined up on the hill. All of them, so the little colorful houses, just like San Francisco, but all of them have that rooftop, the Japanese style rooftop on it. So there's this cool mesh of cultures happening.
So I guess we're supposed to assume this is, you know, I mean, it's clearly not based in any kind of reality, but we're supposed to assume this is like in some sort of utopian future where cultures have come together more.
Yeah. I mean, I thought of it a little bit like Firefly, the combination of American and Chinese culture meshing together almost perfectly. But obviously that was totally different.
But it's, thing. You see that in a lot of sci-fi. I think they did that quite a bit in Blade Runner too. Mm-hmm. Kind of assuming that in the future the Asian culture and American culture are going to blend and people are going to start speaking kind of both languages and
weird combination.
Yeah. And it also gives them the excuse to have all this sort of Japanese anime inflection on the movie. I liked it quite a bit. And I think that the robot, design is really cool and the characters are really cool. I wasn't sure about the superhero angle of it. Because it was marketed weird that they didn't let that out. And B, because I kind of felt like the movie didn't need to be that movie. like, I like those two characters so much. And actually, the supporting cast is a lot of fun, too. But as soon as they were like, let's suit up and go fight this guy, and we all have powers now, I was like, oh, okay, I guess that's what this movie's going to be now. And
it became really weirdly meta really quick, because yeah. I had that character, Fred character, who was obsessed with comic books and stuff, right. And then all of a sudden they were comic book superheroes.
He's pretty much like the one character from Community.
No. He was a little Abed.
Yeah.
But he was like, if Abed's character and Shaggy from Scooby-Doo, like, got together and made a new human, and that was
right.
him.
Or
like,
Pauly Shore from the Goofy movie.
Yes!
Yeah. He's voiced by TJ Miller, and he gets a lot of the best lines in the movie.
I want to talk about the voice cast, mm-hmm. Because it was all totally unknown people, except for, there's two really big names attached to it that they didn't advertise. Did you notice that? They were
I stayed to look at the credits.
They were not into the whole, let's get a bunch of stunt cast together. I'm completely forgetting.
Genesis Rodriguez does the Honey Lemon, the girl. Oh, James Cromwell does the professor from the movie.
Damon Wayne.
And Alan Tudyk does...
Alan Tudyk, that's... Okay.
It's antagonist. Yeah.
Alan Tudyk being the... antagonist, and Maya Rudolph was the aunt.
Yeah.
Those are, like,
and she was a lot of fun. She only has like
fun.
Three tiny little scenes, but she gets a lot to do.
But
in
they
it.
Didn't even advertise that they had like these bigger name actors. The difference I thought between a lot of the more recent, I don't know, DreamWorks or even Disney, they go, look at all these famous people who voice our characters.
Yeah, yeah.
And they list them in the trailer. All the famous people they managed to get a hold of.
Yeah.
And then you get this movie who doesn't do that at all. Because mm-hmm. the focus is on the character and on the story and not on who we got
on
to be
star
in this
power.
Movie.
Yeah.
But they did get some pretty big, like, people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
and mostly the adult cast, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Or Damon Wayans Jr. as the Wasabi. Mm-hmm. He was pretty funny.
So I would say it's definitely worth seeing, and I liked it quite a bit. And it's it has pretty strong emotional beats in it, especially at the beginning, and then it kind of comes around again at the end. I think as the movie progresses, it gets incrementally less interesting.
It changes genre halfway through.
Yeah.
Then becomes a superhero movie, but it becomes the less interesting. I really did want them to focus more on Baymax and Hero and like Hero's emotional journey through it. They did bring it back around by the end to get an extremely emotional moment out
of. Did you
cry? Oh, I sobbed. I cried like a baby. Extremely emotional moment at the end.
Yeah.
That I appreciate it because mm-hmm. it was, I mean.
By that point, it was very necessary.
My 8-year-old cousin saw it.
Yeah.
Before I did. And so I was talking to my aunt and my cousin after I saw it. And I was like, hey, Jack, what'd you think? And he goes, oh, it was so cool. The robot was so cool. But it was sad. And I was like, it was, though. It was weirdly heavy for a kid's movie. Mm-hmm. But I thought in a good way.
Right.
But
right.
then also, but yeah, I mean, we are not its target audience. So,
no, that's true.
So when it gets less interesting for us, I think it got more
interesting for
him.
The kids, right?
So
right. it's not a Miyazaki film,
right?
Well, I kind of wonder too, because I know that this was a. It's, I mean, okay, so this is adapted off of a Marvel comic thing, and it's set in a real on another world, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
the whole Tokyo San Francisco blend,
alternate universe,
yeah.
Earth culture.
Well, I know this started at Pixar. I wonder if they first were developing it, and then Disney were like, we got superheroes in this. Let's do it.
Yeah, like, well, yeah, there's definitely a Marvel Comics inflection on the whole thing.
It definitely wouldn't surprise me at all if it was Pixar that developed the like emotional relationships in it.
Well, Lasseter's the main producer of mm-hmm. it, and he's been producing a lot of the just Disney stuff too.
Yeah, I really like John Lasseter.
Yeah,
and I know through interviews with him and reading stuff that he's written about his work with Pixar and Disney that he recognizes how important emotional depth is to
If you get any of those DVDs, those Miyazaki DVDs released by Disney, he does all the forewords on them. He does a little introduction. So he's a huge Miyazaki fan.
Yeah. And he recognizes especially that, that Miyazaki really nailed a lot of these really emotional stories because that you don't have to sacrifice emotion to make a movie for kids.
Right.
And that's what Pixar has been doing for ages until Cars 2. which wasn't like emotionally impactful at all.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, I can forget it so long as you get Up and you get Wall-E and Toy Story 3 and all of these like truly impactful. They understand how movies can make people feel, and it doesn't matter how old you are.
Yeah.
Big Hero 6 felt like it was so ready for that, as it, just super tragic, like, beginning, and then super sad ending. And then it just went, oh, we cannot let it be like this the whole movie. Ooh, it's gotta be superheroes right now, like, right now.
Yeah.
So I really liked it. I agree with you entirely that it didn't need to be a superhero movie.
It gets a little uneven as far as what kind of movie it wants to be and where it goes.
It got really goofy in the middle.
Yeah.
But
entertaining.
But entertaining. It was still fun. And it was beautiful. Animation was so beautiful.
Did you see it in 3'd or 2'd?
2'd. I saw it in 2'd.
As well.
It was just, I didn't care about seeing it in 3D or 2D. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't matter to me. But it was just the timing. I went to the movies and my mom was like, you're going to see this showing. And it was the 2D one. So. Right.
I usually go for 2D just because it's cheaper. Mm-hmm. Unless it's something like Gravity where it's all important. Wrapped up into the story.
Yeah.
But I feel like this sometimes when I'm watching a 3D movie that I know is made for 3D. Set pieces are designed a certain way. And the story trajectory kind of goes a certain way for 3D moments.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start to see movies do this a lot more where the second half of the movie is almost all fight, action.
Because it looks super good.
Because it's going to look great in 3D. So you have a lot of scenes where he's flying on the back through the buildings.
And yeah, there were moments that I felt like I was almost missing out on something. I was like, man, if I had 3D glasses on, this would probably be super rad.
Yeah, it'd feel like a ride.
Also, they did a lot of that thing that's really, really popular in movies now, especially action movies, where they will slow the action down, like mid hit or whatever, and it goes, it gets really slow for a second.
Yeah.
And then it speeds up again. It's like bullet time, but like animated.
Ramping is what it's
Ramping.
Called.
Ramping! Yeah. I'm so glad there's a word for it.
The Zack Snyder technique.
Yes!
Yes.
Zack Snyder's super into it. And they did that a couple of times where I went, I've seen this before. It's not that interesting, but it might be prettier in 3D.
Right, right.
When they're falling out the window, and he turns around and catches him. As if you see it in the trailers.
I think that exact shot is in Spider-Man 2.
Yes, yes, where he where he catches her midair and is able to turn her. And Batman does it too in The Dark Knight, where he catches the lady and turns her so that she's not going to be the one that takes the impact of the fall.
Right.
It's a classic superhero.
Except for instead of landing on a car and being able to live through it somehow,
he's a balloon.
He's a giant balloon. So, yeah. All right. Well, so let's go ahead and get into Whiplash.
Oh, yeah. You guys do this.
Me and Richard.
Sorry, guys.
Oh, no. It's fine. And I'll let you set that up, Richard.
Okay. So Whiplash stars Mr. Miles Teller. And he basically plays this young jazz musician who wants to be a great and is at one of the best schools for jazz. And he is basically bullied into trying to be better and better by his teacher, played by J.K. Simmons. The premise, like the story premise, is really basic.
Yeah.
But that's not where the movie's interesting. The movie's interesting in what it's kind of about.
Yeah.
The plot wise, and it's really about this teacher really pushing his student to be a great. And I don't know. Like, I think you can have a couple of different ways of looking at this. It can be kind of like that how parents push their kids sometimes too much, and that kind of drive inside. Or it could just be what it takes to be great. It can be either or, really, I think.
Yeah. And you could see that the movie is ambiguous enough that you could see it as, is J.K. Simmons abusive?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this really what it takes to be notable, what it takes to be one of the best?
Well, he's definitely an a-hole. Like, I mean, yeah. there's no way around
that. Yeah.
But does it take that kind of pressure to get to be a great?
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, did you think that this was like a commentary, like, to you, like, about how things are now and everybody's like, oh, it's self-esteem and everything's nice and blah, 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 mm-hmm. and it's all good? Well, did you think that was kind of part of what the person was saying or not?
Yes, this is written and directed by Damien Chazelle. This is pretty much his first feature. He did a short version of this, and then it was expanded for the film. I think there's a few things going on in the subtext here, and I saw it twice, and I'm glad I saw it twice because I noticed more. I think a large part of this movie is about the divisions of sort of Generation Y millennials, if you will, and the baby boomer generation / Generation X, kind of, where they had this drive, this incentive, or they feel like they had this drive and incentive that, you know, competition is incredibly important. And, you know, he pretty much runs his jazz ensemble like a drill sergeant. And he, you know, yells right in their face. He's constantly flinging out homophobic slurs the entire time. And plays members against each other, which I think is the most insidious thing he does. He creates competition on purpose between different players.
Well, not just competition, but contention. Like, he straight up causes, like, he's manipulative.
Right, right. And I think, you know, he has a few good monologues in this movie where he talks about, like, Buddy Rich, who Miles Teller sort of, that's his hero and who he worships, and he has a poster of him in his room and in his practice room, and he's trying to become that good. And he says, you know, how did he become one of the greats? It's because during a recording session, you know, the other guy threw a cymbal at his head, and he went and practiced and came back, and had that never happened, and he had said, you know, oh, just try again, you're fine. You know, Buddy Rich would have never had the incentive or drive to get that good. And so in a weird way, you understand his logic, but you also understand that there is a point where you can go too far, and there is a point where, the relationship between the two, these two actors, who I think are both phenomenal in this movie, and it is an actor's showcase more than anything else, although it's very tightly directed as well. It reminded me a lot of the back and forth you got, from Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman in The Master, where there's just these scenes where it's just the two of them, you know,
playing off of each other.
Playing off of each other, and it's just all actors' energy, and they're just, you know, in that perfect kind of hum of synergy between the two of them. And it's just incredible to watch. The other thing that I think is going on in this movie, besides commentary of the two generations and the different mindsets, of self-esteem generation and the, you know, competition generation. I think this is a movie about paternity and fatherhood.
Right.
And because Miles Teller's father is played by, his real father is played by Paul Reiser. Yeah, so the mother left them. Paul Reiser never really achieved what he was supposed to achieve as a writer, as a creative person. Miles Teller wants to, you know, supersede the expectations of the family. And I think the J.K. Simmons character sort of becomes this weird surrogate father to him. And he ends up, it becomes much more important to Miles Teller to impress the J.K. Simmons character than it does his father. And there's even like little things, like at the beginning where they're at the movie and he pours the raisinettes in the popcorn, and they're watching it together, and Miles Teller's like, oh, that's gross, I'm just going to eat around them. And the Paul Reiser character says, I don't understand you. And I think that's kind of repeated later in a scene where Miles Teller's feeling really good about being in this jazz ensemble and making head chair of the drums. And he has, you know, all this excitement about his prospects, and his family just does not get it at all. And he sort of takes it out on them. And then, of course, at the end, which I'm not going to spoil because I think this is one of the most captivating last 15 minutes of a movie, at least this year, if not the last 5 years, that the, you know, the father figure thing comes back very strongly. And yeah, I love this movie. I think it's a near perfect film.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very, I think it's a very good film. I'm a little, I guess I'm a little hesitant because I feel like almost like I'm a little biased because, okay. So I do think it's very much more of an acting showcase than anything. Yeah. I do think the story, and I think that's actually kind of a testament to the directing to kind of let that happen.
Mm-hmm.
However, coming off of, Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
I thought that that was a more, like, I'm having trouble because this is a very good movie as well.
Yeah.
But that film had a lot more charisma to me and had a little bit more going on. And so this film, I don't know. It's almost kind of like, it's weird because we were talking about the movie Rush, but it's a movie that I thought of when I thought of this movie.
Okay.
Because it's two actors really going against each other. And
yeah.
It has more, no, not really even that much more subtext. I will say about the ending though, Yurik. I agree with you completely. The ending is captivating and really brings it all together. But I don't know. I think mostly the big takeaway is the performances. Both okay. Miles Taylor and J.K. Simmons.
Yeah.
But I mean it's a good movie. It's a really good movie, but I don't know if I'm as enchanted by it as you are. It
Fair
seems
enough.
Like anyways. But
I just really love the maintained tension throughout the whole thing. It's almost like a thriller in the way it's built, and you can look at it as an actor showcase because that's the biggest takeaway. But I think the direction does require a lot that to keep the movie on that same level of intensity through its whatever it is almost 2 hours.
Well, I think that's where the music comes in. Like, honestly.
Right. And the sound design is a big part of it.
Yeah. Because the sound design, I mean, with that elemental, because a lot of times you're not looking at the full, I mean, the jazz does come in.
Mm-hmm.
You're also looking at those, like, stripped down, very elemental, like, drum sounds. Mm-hmm. Like, that's another part that was kind of like, I was like, whoa, man, that's interesting. And I mean, there's a lot of that was interesting about the sound, too, because, like, when you listen to the first jazz group, you're like, oh, okay, cool, whatever, kind of background music. But then when you come in and you hear the like, I guess the varsity, I don't know what else to call it, but the senior kind of like jazz group, you notice a significant difference in the sound between the two.
Yeah, it's much tighter.
And so, I don't know, there is for sure that the story is very interested in the difference between the generations.
Yeah.
And kind of...
the different values.
Yeah. And but I do think it is kind of weird that there is kind of like almost a gap missing of where Generation X, because I mean, I guess that is like the baby boomers versus like the millennials, which are like literally the children of.
Yeah.
But I'm just kind of like, huh, like what, you know... Like, well, seems like there's an absence almost somewhere to me.
Well, I mean, there's a few places in the movie I think things could have been expanded if they chose to do that. It is so tightly wound, both the screenplay and the direction, that's almost kind of bare bones and very minimalist.
So
I feel like there's places that, like, there's a female character in this movie. Who plays Miles Teller's girlfriend that he kind of meets at the movie theater, and they have like one or two flirtatious scenes. And then she pretty much gets written out of the movie without really ever a chance to develop as a character. And I kind of feel like the movie is a very masculine film in general. Did you notice there's one girl in the first band ensemble, and then when he moves to J.K. Simmons' ensemble, there's no women.
When you re-pointed out, that is an interesting. I never thought about some of the gender dynamics, but I did notice that it was a masculine film.
And then mom is out of the picture before the movie even starts. So, I mean, this movie is, like, I think very much about masculinity and sort of that sort of father-son dynamic.
For sure, yeah.
In a way that it almost feels, it almost reminded me of like a 70s film in that way, and then it's ultra male dominated in a way that, you know, the one female character almost isn't even a character.
Well, I was almost thinking, is that like a commentary? Because I know like a lot of people.
It could be intentional. It could not be. If I'm looking at the movie with the benefit of the doubt, I think it is intentional. I could definitely see somebody else.
Well, it could just,
seeing it as a criticism.
Well, it could just be art reflecting life too, because I mean,
yeah,
there is a kind of a commentary about a lot of the high art, if you will, mm-hmm. is kind of male dominated and kind of a boys' club. In a sexist right. kind of way, so
yeah, I think I feel like the movie's kind of about that. But...
So it could be either. Mm-hmm. I think it could be intentional or it could be just kind of subvertly in there, because I don't think the movie is. I mean, it's definitely masculine, but I wouldn't say that it's really talking about gender that much. I think it's talking more generational and more definitely the parental. I guess the fraternal would be the best way to say that.
Right. What about you, Alyssa? Have we convinced you either way?
I forgot that this movie was coming out, and I remember seeing that Miles Teller was going to be in it. I really like this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that I've seen him in and do, I'm intrigued by him. So he kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I remember when I went with Brad and Amanda to go see Birdman at the Arclight, and it was playing there, and I was like, oh, that's the next movie I want to see. And then I forgot until you guys.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I wonder what Whiplash is that they're going to be talking about. And then you pulled it up and went, oh, that's the movie I'm so in. I just haven't seen it yet.
It was only playing in one theater here in Orange County, but now it's expanded, so it's playing in most of the theaters. Well, it's definitely at the Arclight.
Yeah.
Well, and if you like Miles Teller, I would say... To me, anyways, this is his best performance so far.
Really?
Easy peasy.
Yeah. I really liked him in The Spectacular Now, but this is really good too. Yeah. And it's a much more broody, internal kind of performance.
Cool. Mm-hmm. No, I'm excited. I like J.K. Simmons.
Yeah.
Too,
and
so.
He, I know like it's a dark part, but you know, he's having so much fun being able to deliver this just horrendously mean dialogue.
Well, he's a gruff. I mean, he just gives off a gruff kind of ambiance in general. Like, I mean, just in any film, he can be a nice dad. I mean, I still remember him from Juno when he talks about when he tells he's going to kick or punch Michael Cera in the balls. That was one of the best things ever. But in this performance, he's definitely, I don't know. It shows that evil dark side of him in just like the most beautiful way.
He's possible. Going back to his Oz days.
All right. No, that's awesome. I definitely want to see it.
And even the way he
interesting
like,
that you pointed out that that there's really no girls in it.
I noticed it more the second time than the first time, but yeah.
I'm definitely not one of those girls who's like, I demand there be women in this story or else I can't relate to it. But I know a lot of people who are like that, who take the Bechdel test like literally and extremely seriously.
This fails with flying colors on the Bechdel test.
But I'm not one of those people, so I'm super down for it. Because I think it's silly. And why can't you relate to a character if you can't physically identify with them?
Yeah.
In a way, there's kind of like a social network to this world of of high college jazz and sort of like geniusness and like alienating the people in your life to be a genius.
That's a good juxtaposition for this film, actually. Yeah.
Social network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of has
really,
that tone.
I really like The Social Network.
Yeah, me too.
That's a good movie.
Jabber and the Drone approved Social Network.
Awesome. Did Miles Teller and company, did he do like his own drum work in this movie? Like, was he?
I think he does a lot of it. He does play drums in real life, and I've seen him do interviews about it. He doesn't play jazz drumming. He kind of grew up on rock drumming.
Sure.
And he had to like relearn how to hold the sticks and that kind of stuff for jazz. I think it is both him and a body double when necessary. I think a lot of the soloing, you'll see cuts from the waist down.
Yeah.
Or just the hands and the drums from an aerial point of view.
Sure.
in the coverage, but there's a lot of scenes where it's just a tight shot of him and he's doing it all. And I don't know if that's his audio or not.
I love jazz music.
Yeah.
I have a small jazz background, vocal jazz. Mm-hmm. So now I really want to see it.
Yeah.
It has to be a double though, because
some of it, yeah.
It's
a lot
like,
of it, of
well,
it,
it's like in, like when they were giving, Natalie Portman crap in Black Swan. Like,
yeah.
Like, these are like,
I'm sorry,
master
I'm not
ballerinas.
An amazing
like,
ballerina.
What are you gonna do?
I'm sorry that the professional ballerinas literally learn this from age 3 and Natalie Portman's not that.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Come on. She's also like 5 foot nothing and.
Yeah.
Like, that's not how ballerinas are built. That's so funny. I love that movie too. By the way,
that's another Jabber and the Drone approved, apparently.
Yay!
Well, let's go ahead and now and get into the Netflix homework. Woody Allen's The Purple Rose of Cairo, which came out in 1985, starring Jeff Daniels, Mia Farrow, and Danny Aiello. I've been seeing a lot of movies on accident with Danny Aiello. He's like not a very well-known character actor.
What has he done? I don't know.
He was the abusive husband in this.
Well, yeah.
And he was in Do the Right Thing. I just watched him in Jacob's Ladder not that long ago. And he showed up as a really small character in Larry Cohen's The Stuff, which we reviewed on the show.
Huh.
You're right.
How weird.
But The Purple Rose of Cairo is one of Woody Allen's more fantasy-like movies. And takes place during the Depression. And Mia Farrow is in a terrible abusive relationship.
Sad.
She's working for the two of them as a waitress, and not a very good waitress at that. Danny Aiello plays craps all day, comes home drunk, and beats on her. Although that's mostly off camera.
And says it too, like, I'm gonna beat on you if you don't do what I say.
That's just how I love you. What do you want?
That's how I am. It's the whiskey. I can't handle. I can't control it. It's the whiskey.
Right, and it's almost weirdly played for laughs.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's also a cinephile and she loves the movies and that's her escape. And that's her way to like see a better life is she goes to this tiny little theater, this one screen theater that shows movies all day in town and probably plays the same movie for weeks. And she just goes and sees the same movies over and over and over again and just dreams of being in a better, more exotic world in 1930s cinema. And she goes to the diner and tells everybody who's willing to listen about all the characters and all the actors and their backstories and the stuff she's probably read from the trades. Yeah, nobody cares. Nobody gets it. Danny Aiello doesn't even want to go to the movies with her. And then one day, after she loses her job and pretty much everything's going wrong for her, the main character, or not the main, minor character, from The Purple Rose of Cairo, a movie she's going to see multiple times, played by Jeff Daniels, steps off the screen. And kind of puts everyone's lives in disarray, and maybe she'll get with him, and maybe the studio has to come and figure out how to get him back in the movie.
Maybe
and
the actor has to show up, and you get two Jeff Danielses on screen at the same time.
What did you guys think of The Purple Rose of Cairo? Alyssa, I'll let you start.
Okay, like I said before, you guys are the movie guys, and I realize, okay, so I didn't look
You've
this,
been in movies.
I've been in movies, but I don't have the movication that you guys have, to re-quote Pitch Perfect for the third time this podcast. I don't have the movication that you guys do, but so I didn't look this movie up at all before I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
I literally just typed it into Netflix and hit go and sat down. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't even know it was a Woody Allen movie.
Mm-hmm.
It became really obvious within the first couple minutes. I was like, oh, this must be a Woody Allen movie. because there's opening credits and Mia Farrow was in it. And then also just the whole thing just screams Woody Allen at you. Except that this is only the second Woody Allen movie I've ever seen. I've only seen Midnight in Paris and this movie.
Which are the two that are probably the most alike.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I was really excited. This, Midnight in Paris, I love that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really love that movie. Also, as an English major and the whole seeing my literary idols on screen kind of super fun for me. I really loved this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I was hesitant. I was like, oh, I don't know anything about it. It's like an older movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, Woody Allen and fantasy. And And I've literally never seen Jeff Daniels in anything except for Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah. So, he won an Oscar for this, or was at least nominated.
I was totally in shock when all of a sudden there he was, being not the guy in Dumb and Dumber. So this movie was a super new experience for me altogether, being an older Woody Allen movie, and the first time I saw Mia Farrow do anything, first time seeing Jeff Daniels do anything but Dumb and Dumber. I fell in love really hard, really fast.
Yeah.
Because I was hesitant, and then she was working in this diner. I was like, boring, boring, boring. Whoa, this is amazing. And I just like fell in love and couldn't tear my eyes away from the screen. Like the whole rest, I stayed up so late watching this movie.
Thank you for that, by the way.
Oh no, my absolute pleasure, because this is going on a list of great movies. Like I would recommend this to anybody. Mm-hmm. I thought it was super funny, and really sweet. And it had, Mia Farrow's character was just, she was so sad, and so she was beat up on, and they lived in this horrible little place in New Jersey. And I was so ready for this big, beautiful, happy ending for her, which is when I remembered it's a Woody Allen movie. I was like, distraught. Why don't I get this big, beautiful? But that was like the point. I understand that it was the point. I just still really wanted a big, beautiful, happy ending.
There's a lot of whimsy in this movie, and it's a pretty light on its toes for most of it, even as it's dealing with this darker subject matter. But if you actually look at the movie, what it's really about, this woman escaping the terribleness that is her life, any way she can.
Which is really,
it's a really dark movie.
No, really, the only thing she can do, she gets up, she packs up and tries to leave. I'm gonna leave. Oh crap, all that's out there is I can be a prostitute. Not gonna happen. Yeah. Turns around she goes back to her horrible, horrible husband.
She sees Diane Weiss saying, oh, we can get a lot of money out of this place.
Oh yeah, look at all those men.
However, there's a great scene later on with the character of Jeff Daniels when he gets
Tom Baxter still in his little pith helmet.
That was actually my favorite scene. It was so good. Fantastic.
It was just so funny. And like you said, weirdly enough, even the abuse was kind of played for laughs, but more in a way that just made me go like,
you're only supposed to laugh so much.
I just felt the humor of it just made it that much sadder. And I think that even though I have the tiniest Woody Allen experience ever, as far as I know about him and about the movies that he makes and my experience with him and people talking about his movies, that's kind of big for him. Like,
he has a pretty pessimistic outlook on life. Yeah. I think that's sort of what he's known for.
Like I really loved, and I've said this before, that Hollywood loves movies about Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Hollywood loves movies about making movies. And they also love movies about war, but that's like a totally different thing. So, which is why Argo did so well, because it was a movie about making movies and about war at the same time.
Yeah.
Hollywood loves that shit. But this movie being about the escape that movies can provide for this woman, and how the only thing that she's really got going for her is that she can, for 2 hours or an hour and a half a day, or she'll see the movie like four times a day or something. Yeah, she just sits there and watches it all day long. That is the only thing that can save her. And that's horrible, but the movie ends with a smile on her face. She still has...
She's glad to be at the movies.
She's watching Fred and Ginger dance and I just... As pessimistic as it is, and as pessimistic as Woody Allen is, that little tiny smile that she's got at the end, the little twinge of hope, really, it meant a lot to me to watch it. Mm-hmm. It was, I don't know, I felt really content at the end of it. Like, I had just, not just watched a movie, but had, like, an experience and learned, I learned something about movies by watching this movie. I really, really loved it. That's all I have to say about that.
What about you, Richard?
No, yeah, I completely charming, wonderful movie. I actually haven't seen a lot of Woody Allen as well. I think maybe this is my like fourth film of his, and I think that's a movie a year, so that's not a very good ratio. But no, this was completely charming, and the scene mentioned earlier in the whorehouse was, I think, quite possibly a perfect scene.
Like, right.
So good.
Right.
Like, how he talks to him, how it's directed, everything about it is just...
The dialogue is really spot on, yeah.
And the subtext and the subject matter is beyond a doubt smart and funny. And I mean, he does sell that darkness, but he gives you a lot of darkness, but he sells it with the comedy, you know?
Yeah.
Because I don't think somebody, like, unless you're into like darker stuff, I don't think you could normally, without the humor, kind of just like, you know, sit through that kind of stuff. But
yeah, see the non-movie version of this story.
And to me, this is kind of his commentary about kind of rom-coms, which he's kind of known for in a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting to see him be like, okay, there's a fantasy element to this that's not true at all and isn't, you know, and doesn't exist in the real world.
Yeah.
And that's something that, I don't know, it's, you're right, without that ending... And I didn't want a happy ending. I was glad that it ended the way it did.
Oh, no, I was... I'm just a hopeless romantic, and I really, really wanted him to take her away from everything. Or for her to just go be in a movie. That would have been so cool.
Yeah.
But, we've jumped over this, though. The scenes with the characters.
Yeah, who are waiting, waiting around, because they don't have their minor
character. They literally can't do anything without him.
Yeah.
Because even though he's a minor character, he's like the linchpin of the whole story. We can't do this without Tom. And
so they're just arguing with the people in the theater.
Was so funny.
Yeah.
So funny. And
there's no
also,
minor.
There's no.
Yeah, go for it.
There's no minor characters, just minor actors.
Yeah.
and that was a funny commentary too on the idea of he was like, I'm not a minor character. He feels like his own like he's
his
so
own story.
Important, but
yeah.
I don't know. That just,
well, it's almost talking about how like. Without that, because in every movie they just want to shove romance in your mouth and in your throat, and so this is almost like a commentary on like what Hollywood like would do without that romance in a movie, you know? Because if they didn't have it, they wouldn't even know what to do, and neither would anybody else, because that's what they're so used to seeing and having. That's the fantasy there. So it's pretty. I don't know. Even in a film. Well, the thing is that film that the film that's on the film.
Yeah, the movie within the movie, The Purple Rose of Cairo. Yeah,
there we go.
So bad. It was so bad. I would not watch that movie.
I don't know. I'm kind of into corny old movies like that sometimes.
Well, without that character, though, like, I mean, it's funny because that film falls apart, but that he's not what the film's about. So it's sort of weird.
And you could also see like an extratextual thing happening here too, because at this point in Woody Allen's career, he had been playing essentially himself in a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. And I think the world at large was kind of confusing real Woody Allen, who is the writer director of these movies, and Woody Allen as he plays himself in these movies, a heightened version of himself. And so later in the movie, when Tom Baxter meets the actor who plays him, both Jeff Daniels, and they're arguing over, you're just a character, you're not real. like I'm a person with real emotions. I think
I
you could
made you.
Yeah, I made you. You could see sort of a commentary on how Woody Allen was feeling sort of bifurcated at that point in his life.
I never would have thought of that. That's
I only thought about this
you're
this last
the
time
genius.
I saw it.
Yeah, I think Jeff Daniels did a really good job in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Just crazy to me, and now I'm, oh no, I'm still not gonna see Dumb and Dumber 2. That's not gonna happen. I've thought about it for a half a second and then realized what I was thinking. Like, no, that's not gonna happen for me.
I might end up seeing it, we'll see what
I
happens.
I was not that big of a fan of the first one, so I'm not a big enough fan
to care about the second one.
Another fun fact I just read, this is Woody Allen's favorite movie he ever made.
It's one of my favorite. I would say I've seen probably a third of his films, it's probably in my top four or five. Yeah, for sure.
He said, on according to the this IMDb page, he said on multiple occasions when they say, hey, what's your favorite movie? Yeah. You've ever made? And he's like, Purple Rose.
Yeah, and he's very critical of his work. He usually can't even watch movies that people say are their favorite.
He just loves it. And like you said, he did pour a lot of himself into it. Other fun facts on this page included that the Little Cinema was based on one in his hometown, and it was torn down when he was a young man, and like that had like a big effect on him, and so he did make this movie really personal for him, but it doesn't feel like it. It's so much so that, I mean, like, you see him in all of his own movies playing himself.
Yeah.
I mean, even I know that. Even I could recognize him in a movie playing himself, and I haven't even seen the movies, just clips. But this one, I think, is probably the most real for him, even though it's...
It definitely has a big... it is, even though he is not in it, and it feels less contemporary, it feels more sort of magical, and all of these, and fantasy-driven, it is still very much a personal film in that way. Actually, this would be a good double feature with Hugo, the Martin Scorsese movie.
It would be.
They're both sort of about the love of cinema.
Well done.
Well, let's go ahead and wrap up the show. I have a bunch of garbage I have to read here. But if you want to plug your podcast and lead them to your favorite links.
Okay. Once again, I am Alyssa Witte, co-host of the Quarter Life Crisis Podcast. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/QuarterLifeCrisisPodcast. You can download our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean. We like Podbean. Go to quartercrisis.podbean.com. You can follow us on Twitter at 1QLCPodcast. And then from there, you can follow us all individually. I like to think I'm an entertaining follow, if you want to follow me. I have a blog that I run for the podcast, quarterlifecrisispodcast.tumblr.com, if that's what you're into, you know.
The kids like the Tumblr.
Yes, the kids love the Tumblr. So if you're, if you're listening to this and you want to give us a shout out, we love to hear from you and all of that. We love the Jabber and the Drone. They're our favorite. And I don't really know what else I'm supposed to say in this. I haven't done this without Brad and Amanda. They usually remind me if I've forgotten something.
I think you pretty much got it all. And we'll definitely link everybody to your stuff.
And we'll link everybody to your stuff.
As you should.
And it's all good, too, because Cassidy always reads off the thing. I always ignore him when he's doing it.
Yeah. At this point, Richard starts looking on his phone or whatever.
Awesome.
You can email us if you have anything to say about any of the movies we talked about today. Whiplash, The Purple Rose of Cairo, or Big Hero 6 at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. We will read your responses on air. I don't just say that for funsies. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, as well as on Twitter at jabberpodcast. We currently have 4 more followers than your...
What?
So we are in competition.
Did you hire somebody to do a bot?
No. If I was going to like pay for bots to follow us, we would have like 500, not 24.
You didn't pay per penny.
You can find us on Stitcher and iTunes as well. When you're on iTunes, please write us a review and leave a 5-star rating.
We love that.
We are also on Pocket Cast. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can find some of the stuff I've written for MacGuffin, the Seattle-based website, at mcguff.in/authors/Cassidy. You can read Richard's stuff at his blog, rdwally.weebly.com. You've already mentioned Quarter Life Crisis, so I don't have to.
Yeah.
I will be appearing shortly in the Reaction podcast. I did an interview about Jabber and the Drone there, and I assume they probably talk about the podcast as well. I don't know if that's been posted yet, but when it does, I will retweet as well as put it on our Facebook, so more reasons to follow us there. And until then, we will talk to you next week. Thank you for coming on the show, Alyssa.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me. Sorry for talking your ear off the whole time.
It's okay.
I have like a problem.
No.
I just talk a lot.
Not at all. You're very charming. So.
Aw, that's awful nice of you to say.
Richard's married.
Whoa, what was that, Cassidy? My gosh.
We'll talk to you next week. Bye.